Michael Gellert, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
After some technical challenges, we've been struggling with getting linked up here for, about 20, 25 minutes. So I'm glad we finally got everything working. We're going to be discussing your recent book, The Divine Mind, Exploring the Psychological History of God's Inner Journey. Now, I want to jump in right away and ask you to reassure any listeners who might be offended by the idea of exploring the psychological history of God's inner journey. They might be thinking, how can this guy know anything about God's inner journey? So,
well, it does seem to be an absurdity that we can imagine that we know what goes on inside God, inside his mind, inside his heart. I'm not claiming any particular access to that any better than anybody else has.
Okay.
Most of what the book is about, it looks at the scriptures of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as well as the writings after those scriptures were closed, canonized and closed, right up through the mystics of the Middle Ages and up to modern times. And I'm looking at the hints that scripture and the sacred writings of the mystics say or offer us, that give us a sense that God is actually going through his own inner journey. He is, yes, going through his own religious experience.
Well, maybe what we could say is that the people who wrote those scriptures that evolved and changed over time, the depiction of God, which is, you know, perhaps our projection, and that changed over time.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We're looking at these projections, these metaphors. Really, the only way we know God is through our own experience. So when you look at the evolution of God through all these centuries, what you also see is that our own understanding is evolving, our own capacity for insight, and the two go hand in hand. But we shouldn't minimize the power of a projection. They're very powerful. We have to remember that, for example, in ancient Greece, when the Greeks saw Pan at his noonday or midnight hour, which he often appeared, they would see Pan literally in front of them, hoofing and puffing and stamping on his goat-hooved feet as if he himself were having a panic attack. Now, today we don't experience panic that way. We experience it internally. But in their day, they experienced panic externally. And that is because back then, the dividing line between the ego and the mythopoetic or imaginal psyche, the collective unconscious where these experiences come from, the dividing line between the unconscious and the ego wasn't so sharp.
Yeah, I'm remembering a book to that effect. Maybe you know the title of the book that I'm thinking about.
Maybe.
I wish I could give you more hint.
James.
The Bicameral Mind.
The breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Right, and he makes that that argument very forcefully that back in those days, the line between what we call reality and the internal world was not so sharply drawn and experienced as it is for most of us today.
That's right. His actual physiological theory of what goes on in the brain has been more or less discarded because of the findings of recent neuroscience. So his explanation of how that works wasn't quite holding up.
Yeah.
So there are other authors who say the same thing, Eric Neumann, particularly in Jungian psychology. And if we just stay in the realm of psychology, it's safe to say that the ego had not yet clearly separated out of the unconscious, and that things were experienced, what we experience in dreams and visions was the way the ancients actually experienced externally. So when you read the Hebrew Bible, all these wonderful, miraculous stories of Yahweh, the God of the Hebrew Bible, they actually may have experienced them exactly the way they describe them, because there was no inner and outer to make a projection. They saw it and they lived it as if it were right before their eyes.
You know, and I think that helps us make sense of the reports of so-called primitive peoples, that there are still tribes that exist in various parts of the world, and they have shaman, and shaman report these same sorts of experiences, not as imaginary experiences, but really as something that they vividly and fully experience in their reality.
That's absolutely right. The anthropologist Levi Bruhl, and Jung borrowed a lot from him talking about this issue as well, called this participation mystique, a mystical participation between the individual and the world around them. So yes, that's true with the primitives as well.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Just add.
Yeah.
The word symbol or myth was not a word in the language of the ancients or of primitive cultures, because you only know a symbol when you're outside of it and you can see it as a symbol. They were in it, living it daily.
Yeah.
The real thing.
Yeah, yeah. So that is that's an important distinction.
Thing for us.
Yeah.
It's still the real thing for us, except we need to go inside to encounter that. Dreams or visions or meditation or our imagination, cultivating the religious imagination.
Right. And I want to remind people, since I haven't introduced you as a Jungian analyst, that you are in fact a Jungian analyst. Okay. And so that's why you're using some of the terms that you are. And one term that you use in the book is the Abrahamic religions. And so it probably would make sense to say something about what you're getting at there.
Sure. The Abrahamic religions are those traditions that originated with Abraham in the Hebrew Bible and his revelation from God. And those religions are basically Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Although each of those traditions have different theologies and different explanations of their origins, they all agree on the main source or origin, which was the encounter between Abraham and God. Now, there are a couple of other minor, more than a couple, there are about five or six minor Abrahamic traditions. The Samaritans, whom we hear about in the New Testament, are still around and living in the Middle East. The Baha'i faith, these also go back to Abraham, and there's a few others as well. But the main ones, and these are the ones I talk about in The Divine Mind, are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Okay. And as you mentioned when we first started talking about the book, you examine the evolution across three periods of time. And so let's start with the vision of God that comes through in the Old Testament, or older versions of, maybe not everybody calls it the Old Testament. What are we talking about here?
Well, yes, that's right. Actually, the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament, people tend to think these two are synonymous. The contents are the same in both, but the Hebrew Bible is the original version that the authors organized into a text that has three parts. And what the Old Testament is a rearrangement of the last two parts. So actually, what Christians understand as the Old Testament is different than what the Jews understand as the Hebrew Bible. And the difference is largely that the arc of God's inner journey is different, tells a very different story with a different conclusion than the Old Testament. And the Old Testament was revised actually by the New Testament editors. They wanted to make the Old Testament and the New Testament dovetail each other. And therefore they rearranged it so that that would happen.
Yeah, my wife read this book that she told me about, and I should have read it. God's, again, you might know it. It describes in great detail how the Bible, and I don't remember if it was just the New Testament, it was sort of more or less in Elizabethan times, I think, that a committee made a lot of decisions about what would be considered, what would go in the Bible and what should not. It was a committee decision, which I find.
Well, there was the, I think it was in the 4th century, the Nicaea Creed or committee decided what would go in to the New Testament and what would be considered either apocryphal or even heretical. I'm not sure about when the Old Testament was codified. It was definitely in the Christian era. It was after the 2nd or 3rd century, I believe. And it could have been in the Middle Ages when King James's version of the Bible was codified by a committee under King James.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. It was like God's copywriters or God's something like that. So what's the vision that comes through, the vision of God that comes through this first phase that we would relate to the Old Testament or parts of the Quran and what was the other book? I'm not doing very well here.
The New Testament.
Okay, the New Testament. Okay. So I thought the New Testament comes along later, though.
Well, the Hebrew Bible goes from roughly 2000 BC to 200 BC. And that's the first phase, the original vision of God, which more or less Jews, Christians, and Muslims all agree upon.
Okay. The second that vision of God is...
And the vision of God is, as you read in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, the image of God the Creator that we have in the book of Genesis. He then evolves into a war god, particularly during the Exodus and after the Exodus, when the Israelites were led by God into the land of Canaan and the promised land, and they had to conquer all the different peoples who were at that time inhabiting the land. And we here see that Yahweh is very much a kind of commander in chief. He is like the war gods of all the other Near Eastern and the Greek cultures as well. And he's experienced externally. He's modeled as a kind of superhuman hero. He is even visualized as having a body. And he's very much containing our anthropomorphic projections of what God is.
Yeah, for example, he's described as an angry God, as a jealous God. Is that part of this first?
That's right. Period? He's an angry
so these sound very much like human emotions and human limitations.
Yes, and his behaviors are very human too. You can count at least 70 separate episodes of genocide in the Hebrew Bible that Yahweh ordered the Israelites to commit. So we think of genocide as a relatively modern phenomenon. The word genocide comes from the last century, but the actual practice of it, all the ancient cultures practiced it, believe it or not. They felt that to conquer an enemy who didn't surrender voluntarily, they needed to be extinguished. Man, woman, child, even their animals. So you get this image of God that is anthropomorphic, but also quite brutal, quite tyrannical. I quote Freud in the divine mind as saying that he is an uncanny demon or volcano god who walks about at night and strikes without warning. He was quite a character, and he had his own, and this is the thing I try to show very much in The Divine Mind, that he had his own sense of rejections from the Israelites, because they were very ambivalent about taking on this god as their god. So every time he felt rejected, he would act out in this wrathful way. And what you really see is a god who feels rejected and scorned. And that creates a kind of dynamic that runs right through the Hebrew Bible. And it's the main thrust of the story. The people bond with God, then they tire of him or they fear him, and then they go into idolatry as other ways of worship. And God reacts punitively, then the people reconnect. And it goes like that from the beginning to the end of the Bible, starting with the exile from the Garden of Eden, and then Noah's flood. And finally, you come at, toward the end of the Bible to the Babylonian exile, which is a whole episode on its own. Now, that phase of God's journey ends around 200 BC. And then you get the further scriptures and traditions that evolve out of Judaism.
Okay, now before you go there, I just want to underscore the idea that this is maybe not a picture of God as much as it is a picture of our projections of the primitive state of our consciousness at that period.
Yes.
During that period.
Yes, yeah. That's right. The history or the inner journey of God is our history of his inner journey. What he actually was going through, that's a mystery. But if we follow the scriptures and then the sacred writings that came after the scriptures, there's a sense that God is evolving. And yes, he's evolving in the same parallel way as our consciousness is. And as we become more refined, more sophisticated, more humanitarian, so does God. Till you finally come up to the mystics, where God is emptied.
Wait, you're leaping ahead, though, over one, over the second. Let's go to the second phase first. So tell us about how that vision changes in the New Testament, the Talmud, and the Quran.
Right. It bifurcates, and each tradition, God goes off on a somewhat different direction. His personality evolves. But essentially, the features that connect all these traditions together in the second phase is that God becomes more humanistic. He becomes more humanitarian. There you begin to hear the authors of the New Testament and the Talmud talk about God as a source of divine love, God as a source of mercy. He becomes less egotistical and tyrannical than he was in the Hebrew Bible. There's a definite evolution in ethics. The capacity to experience God internally increases. In the Hebrew Bible, God was experienced collectively. It was a theophany as the only way to see God. So everybody would be gathered together, except, of course, the prophets like Moses and Ezekiel. They had a unique experience of God, but it was essentially a collective vision. In the second phase, you begin to get, also especially with the Gnostics, the idea that the individual can find God within themselves. And Jesus's core message was the kingdom of God is within you. So there you really begin to get an indication that the human psyche is the source of religious experience. That's a beginning. It doesn't fully reach its stride until the third phase.
Okay, now it's very interesting to me because I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian environment. And so what you're saying helps to resolve, I think, a philosophical or problem that I think I experienced as a young person. I don't know that I ever fully articulated it, you know, in the way that comes to mind now, of the seeming inconsistency between the Old Testament and the New Testament, that there's this very different experience or way that God is being portrayed, you know, that we've moved from this vengeful, jealous kind of God and all this genocide that you referred to now a more love-oriented God who's sent his only son to go through crucifixion and so on to save us all from sin. So you used a word that I have not heard before there. What was it? It was
theophany.
Theophany. Yeah.
Spell
it for us and then define it, if you will.
T-H-E-O-P-H-A-N-Y.
Theophany.
T-H is like an F, pronounced like an F. And that's a big shift between the first and the second phase, because there, at the end of the first era, the idea of a theophany more or less ends. So God does not appear to all the people all at the same time, like he does at Sinai, where they could see all the people together. They could see the light of the burning bush on the mountain. They could see the cloud that led them through the desert. They could all experience the manna, the food that God dropped from the heavens down to the people so they could eat in the desert. That kind of collective experience ends. And that has posed a real problem right through the centuries to modern times, because people today, they still ask questions like, for example, this terrible episode that happened last week at that school in Florida. Why does God allow these terrible things to happen? Why did he allow the Holocaust to happen? Why do wars happen? You see, in the old model of the theophany, God could appear and correct those things. But in the second phase, there's not only an enhancement of God's humanitarianism, but there's an enhancement of free will on the part of humans, so that it is no longer left up to God to shape our history. We have our own free will. We're responsible for the evil that we commit, and it's up to us to make a change in that. God helps those who help themselves, kind of thing. So you see, when people ask today why God let the Holocaust happen, well, he didn't let it happen. He just no longer interferes in history in the same way that he did. The era of theophanies are over, so that we're not dependent on God in a kind of slavish way where he appears, tells us what to do, and we do it. It's up to us. And that's the big shift from the first to the second phase.
Hmm. We're almost heading towards an existential viewpoint where we are forced to take responsibility for what's happening in the world and
that's
for
right.
our part in it, which
that's right.
maybe becomes more articulated in the third phase. I don't know.
That's right.
The third phase is moving along is that the vision of God changes with the Jewish, the Christian, and the Islamic mystics. And it's fascinating that there are these mystics from different traditions who what they're saying really tends to overlap and have a lot of similarities regardless of what tradition they're coming out of.
Yes, with the mystics, you find that they agree with each other. And in fact, they didn't work in an isolated way. The Jewish, Christian, and Muslim mystics all knew what the others were doing. And essentially, if you were to take, let's say, a dozen quotes from the Jewish mystics, the Kabbalists, and make a column, and then make a separate column of quotes from the Christian mystics, and then a final column of quotes from the Islamic mystics, and you took away their names underneath those quotes, often you wouldn't know which tradition was saying what, because they share more in common with each other than they often did with the followers of their own traditions. So here you find that the bifurcation in the Abrahamic traditions that happened in the second phase comes together in the third phase, and there's a great similarity. But we also have to remember that the mystics were a minority tradition.
Yes.
In the larger organized traditions of the three religions.
And the way I understand that is that the reason why they're as similar as they are, and this is not based on extensive study, but it's my impression, is that they, what they have in common is that they've gone inside and they've really deeply explored their inner world rather than what's been delivered to them and by tradition or authority. And they discover some basic things about the inner human experience, and the farther reaches of it, I would say.
Yes, and you could say that the mystics were the precursors, the forerunners of psychology. Some of them had very elaborate systems of the psyche. The Kabbalists with their tree of life, showing the different attributes of God that are also different attributes of our own psyche. Teachings of St. John of the Cross had a very explicit systematic methodology of inner transformation. So you're right about that. What you really see in the third phase is a flowering of the basic contribution I mentioned earlier of Jesus when he said, the kingdom of God is within us. Mm-hmm. There you really see with the mystics, they really, they go to the market with that. They really take that to its full limit.
Yeah. So how does what you've described as God's inner journey relate to us and our own inner journey? Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, that arc of his journey that we just talked about, coming from the idea of God as an external being who is a kind of superhuman hero, and then he evolves into a more humanitarian God where there's more of an I-thou dialogue. As Martin Buber would call it, you described it very well as a kind of existential shift. And then you come to the third phase where everything we associate with God is emptied out of our psyches. The experience of emptiness, which you usually think of the Zen Buddhists when you hear that, is very central to the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic mystics. They all have an experience of God's oneness, oneness in all of nature, oneness among all of us. All of us are manifestations of the same Godhead. All of that is an emptying out of the contents we originally perceived God through. He's no longer a particular superhuman hero. He is much closer in many ways to what scientists talk about when they talk about God, and closer to what Spinoza talked about when he talked about the divine. A kind of being who is in and as nature. That arc is something actually, if you look at a human life, most of us go through. Children cannot appreciate the idea of God the way someone like Meister Eckhart or Moses Cordovero from the Kabbalistic tradition talk about. They often experience God the way the Israelites did, as a being, as a person. And then as we grow older, if we're evolving, we come to the second phase, but within ourselves, where we begin to ask questions and not agree with everything God necessarily said in the older traditions. We develop a more of an I-Thou relationship. We develop a side of God that is much more multifaceted, not just two sides, good and evil. We begin to see the gray between the opposites. And then if we come into a more mature, adult-like vision of God for ourselves coming from our deep psyches, where we might have a religious experience of one kind or another. Well, there we're in the third phase of God's journey as depicted in history, but it's a psychological phase for us. So here we see that the historical phases of God's evolution parallel very nicely for most of us, the evolution of God within ourselves, the evolution of the God image, as Jung talked about it.
I think this is a fascinating topic. I'm wondering what personally motivated you. Writing a book like this involves a lot of scholarship, a lot of time, and it must require a certain amount of passion, I would think, to pursue something like this. How do you relate that to your own personal journey?
Well, in the introduction to the book, I say a little bit about that. I could add a little more here. Of course, when I was a young a child, I had this very childlike idea of God. I went to a Jewish religious school, so I read all the stories in the Bible, and I had this idea of God as he's imaged there. A little bit later, when I was around 11 years old or so, I was studying with a rabbi that my parents arranged tutorials for me with. And he introduced me to the Talmud. And the Talmud, which belongs to that second phase of God's evolution, really struck me in a very visceral way as being a departure from the God of the Hebrew Bible. Suddenly, God becomes much more sophisticated, much more introspective, much more, there's a greater emphasis on philosophy. The 613 laws of the Hebrew Bible, of the Mosaic Code, suddenly become a source of dialogue among the rabbis. That had a very deep impression on me. And then at around age 15, another rabbi I was studying with saw that I was getting a little bit impatient with studying just the holidays and the liturgy, and he introduced me to the stories of the Hasidic and Kabbalah masters, and that really had a profound impact on me. Mm-hmm. You really see that God manifests in the everyday lives of these masters in a way that is very intimate and very alive. And then in the introduction, I mentioned an experience that happened to me. I had two of that kind, which introduced me to the experiential side of the mystics. In both episodes, I had fallen into kind of a personal crisis with a depression. In the first one, I was traveling in India and I had a close brush with death. Those led to a kind of awakening that introduced me to the mysticism of all the world traditions. And by the time I come to writing this book, I wanted to focus on what it was in particular that the Abrahamic traditions have to offer us. Because, you know, as you know, in the last 30, 40 years, there's been a real tendency for Westerners to look to the East for mm-hmm. mystical wisdom and for a guide to religious experience. But everything that we find in the East, we find in the mysticism of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as well. And one of the things that inspired me to write the book was to reintroduce Westerners and Muslims to their own traditions from a slightly different point of view, which is this point of view of his psychological inner journey.
Yeah, in fact, you were talking about how Westerners have tended to look to the East, and I saw in your biography that you spent 2 years in a Zen monastery in Japan.
Yes, it was
part of your arc.
Yes, it was part of my arc. It was the Zendo styled after the basic training that goes on in the Zen monasteries. I discovered Zen in a deeper way when I was in graduate school, and I was reading the accounts, the autobiographical and biographical accounts of the Zen masters. I originally wanted David to study with a Kabbalah rabbi, a Kabbalistic rabbi. And my rabbi in Montreal, where I grew up, tried to find me such a rabbi, but none of them would accept me into a pursuit of Kabbalistic wisdom because I lacked some of the basic qualifications. So that dovetailed with my discovery of these writings by the Zen masters, and I said, they're experiencing the exact same thing that the Kabbalah masters are experiencing.
Fascinating.
And they accept me easily because I don't need a lot of prerequisites, and that's how I ended up in Japan.
That's a fascinating story. And what was it that made you want to become a Jungian analyst? I assume that's temporally further down the line.
Yes, that is a later development. When I discovered Zen teachings on meditation, I was practicing Buddhist meditation with a particular group, not the one in Japan, it was in Montreal. And they were a complicated group, and I wasn't quite sure if I was getting the original teachings of Buddhism or something that was a mix-max of eclectic teachings that had certain fundamentalisms about it and certain mm-hmm. New Age aspects. And I had a dream one night that completely answered that question for me in a way that I could understand even before I had ever studied dream psychology. I was a student of comparative religion. I hadn't really discovered Jung yet, but when I had this dream, I wanted to learn more about who designed this dream, because clearly it was more intelligent than I am. It right. answered my dilemmas in a way that my mind wasn't able to wrap around what it was saying until I saw it very clearly in the dream.
Can you share the dream with us?
Yes, I could. To make a long story short, the dream went on for about 20 minutes.
Wow.
In the dream, it was 1974 that I had this dream, and it was not long after the Watergate episode. And I found myself on the floor of the Republican National Convention to elect the Republican candidate for the next presidential election. And I was wondering, what am I doing here? I wasn't even American at the time.
Wow.
It was very alive. It was just like being on the floor of the convention hall, I would imagine. There were balloons flying everywhere and the people with their placards, and on the name of the placards was the state they were from. And it was a very busy, active scene. And there up on the bleachers were a row of people who were doing what is it called in baseball when they take up the signs and they show the signs? There's a word for it.
I'm not enough of a baseball fan. I'm not a baseball fan. I don't know.
They spell out signs. And what was spelled out were the letters in a linear fashion, M, and then I, and then C, K. And these were all signs, you know, each letter had its own sign, and it was huge. And eventually it went to K, E, Y, and then there was a gap, and then came M, O, U, and then I saw clearly
Mickey Mouse.
What you were saying was Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
And I right away knew that the dream was telling me that the group I was training with were a Mickey Mouse version of Buddhism.
Wow, interesting. And it reminds me of Jung's dream where he has this image of God defecating on the church.
It's a similar kind of self-expression of the unconscious sharing its own viewpoint.
Yeah,
really. On something organized, because this group was a small organized religious group, and the unconscious, or we could say the designer of the dream, didn't like this group. What was also interesting about it, it was being spelled out for me as if the unconscious were kind of making fun of me, saying, do you really need to have this spelled out for you? So when I
walked, dummy, look at this.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you get on the head with it. So of course I left that group, and eventually I found my way to an authentic Zen group that has lineage going all the way back to Bodhidharma, who brought Buddhism from India into Tibet and China. But it also, you know, I was in my 20s in that year that I had that dream, and I wanted to learn more about who designed this dream in me. How can a part of me know something so clearly when my ego is completely confused? So I started reading Freud. I wanted to know more about this dream designer. And I got some very good insights from Freud, but I wasn't quite getting the spiritual dimension of our dreams. He didn't really quite talk about that. And then that brought me to Jung. And when I read Jung, I right away knew that this man knows about this aspect of the psyche. And that began my journey to become an analyst.
Yeah, and he also remarked about this tendency to look for religious experience in other cultures and kind of urge people to, you know, look to that culture that you grew up in and find the pearl there.
Yeah, Jung felt that we have a lot we can learn from the Eastern traditions, not only their psychologies, but many of their skill sets, but that the Westerner is probably better off going into his or her own tradition, because that's what his or her psyche is endowed with. Our connection to the collective unconscious is most immediately through our own traditions.
And I'm just curious, during your time in Buddhism, and particularly in the monastery, did you have any sort of breakthrough Satori experience?
Not long after, I had an experience that seemed disconnected from my training in Japan. It had been about 2 years after I left my studying with my teacher in Japan. I had relocated to New York City. And the experience I describe in the introduction to the Divine Mind is that experience. And it really was kind of fashioned and I think made possible because of the years of training I had in Zen.
Now, I noticed that you're a licensed clinical social worker. And I'm not sure that many people in my audience are aware that they can become a Jungian analyst with that degree. Are there many such people that you're aware of? Who?
Yes, today there are. You know, the traditional way somebody would become either a Freudian or a Jungian psychoanalyst, well, certainly a Freudian analyst, if not a Jungian analyst, was through having an MD, a medical degree. But that has broadened in all forms of analysis, so that now you can come in with a master's degree in social work or the MFT, the Master of Family and or Marriage, Family and Therapy degree. I think even registered psychiatric nurses can be qualified for Jungian training. So basically you need a license to practice psychotherapy and a good few years of clinical experience, your own personal analysis, and that qualifies somebody to apply for Jungian training.
Yeah.
So there's a fair spread of different traditions academically.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if, as we wind down here, if there are any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience.
Final thoughts. Well, you know, we live in very difficult and dark times today. And the mystics, which is the high point of the evolution of Western and Islamic religion, taught that it's important to come to terms with this dark side of life and to understand that it is there also in our religious traditions, both historically. There have been inquisitions, there have been holy crusades, but the mystics themselves, they hold the opposites of the light and the dark sides of God together in a way that allows us to integrate them not only side by side with each other, but into our approach to life, so that we remain very conscious of the dark side, but we work with the positive side, which gives us wisdom and insight, gives us compassion and the ability to love one another. The mystics had no quarrels with each other, not like the religions do with each other today, the followers. So my final thoughts would be that the more we cultivate our inner depths and connect to the God within us, the more we also connect with each other. And if we connect with each other deeply enough, we are, whether we recognize it in the moment or not, we are bringing God into the world. That is what the Kabbalists call tikkun olam, the repair of the broken world. We raise it one person at a time. But if we all do this together, the world around us can also transform.
That's a great wrap up. So,
okay.
Michael Gellert, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And thank you, David, for having me.